a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Health and Human Services, welcome to our listening audience. I'd like to call to order. Just a reminder, if you have a cell phone, please silence it. And with that, I'll ask the Secretary to call roll.
Senator Bradford.
Here.
Holeen. Jensen.
Here.
Krebs.
Here.
Rampelberg.
Here.
Schohort.
Here.
And Hunoff.
Here.
Madam Chair, there are six present.
Thank you. We do have a quorum present. I would ask our Paige to come up and push the green button, and please identify yourself. Tell us who you are and where you're from.
My name is Savannah Anderson, and I'm from Timberlake.
Thank you very much. And Senator Bradford, you have a personal privilege.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a group of students here from Kadoka High School, and if they would stand up, and I'd have you welcome them. They're here to observe my so-called actions.
All right. Well, thank you. Welcome. With that, I would entertain a motion to move the minutes.
So moved. Second.
Moved by Senator Holeen, seconded by Senator Rampelberg. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion carried. Thank you. With that, we are going to follow the order of the agenda. So we're going to have a continuation on the hearing of Senate Bill 2115, which provides procedures by which adopted persons may obtain their original birth certificate. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Senator Angie Buell from District 15 in Sioux Falls, and I appreciate the opportunity to kind of revisit what we chatted about on Monday morning and answer any questions you might have. I just wanted to take a moment to remind you of what you all heard in our last hearing. You heard from people on all sides of adoption, from birth mothers to adults who were adopted as children to adoptive parents, all sharing stories about how the current system requiring court orders to obtain original documents and birth certificates is flawed. The judicial process is often arbitrary, so that some adoptees are able to access their own records and some, even those in the exact same situations, are not. This can have really serious consequences, including inhibiting access to vital medical records, and leaves many adoptees with big questions about their own roots and identity. To answer a couple of things specifically, I urge you not to confuse identity with contact. Knowing biological parents' names is not the same thing as contacting them, and adoptees will still be able to utilize the voluntary registry that's maintained by DSS to find out whether or not one or both biological parents has expressed a contact preference. Additionally, please keep in mind that the current system, judges reviewing records are not necessarily asking biological parents now for permission to unseal those at this time. Adoptive parents are also not promised confidentiality at the time of surrender, and they in fact sign away all of their rights, including being able to deny whether an adoptee will eventually get access to their original birth certificate. Also, at the time of that surrender, they're not promised that an adoption will take place, so how could they make an assumption that this will always be sealed if that doesn't take place? The opponent who spoke on Monday also mentioned that all of the petitions that are currently requested are granted. I'm here to tell you that's not true, and you heard from other folks who've had similar experiences, so I think that's pretty black and white. The bill also deals with the Department of Health. That was one question that was raised during opponent testimony. This deals with the Department of Health because that's where the vital records are currently maintained, and so it made sense to keep that in the same house, even though the voluntary registry is maintained by DSS. Although it's not detailed in the bill, I believe we're supposed to have agency folks on hand from both Department of Health and DSS to provide technical info for how they would communicate back and forth. But we've had indications from both departments that they would be able to communicate, and if nothing else, that could be included in the rules promulgation process, since it could be a fairly detailed process that we would want to lay out, maybe not necessarily in statute, but in rule. At the end of the day, there's really no compelling state interest for keeping these records, for keeping the status quo in place, for keeping the court order process as the way that adults usually get original birth certificates. And the court order system also opens up all kinds of things, counseling records, all the adoption records, in addition to the original birth certificate. This bill would keep that information a lot more contained and at the same time allowing adoptees to get the information they're really after. Senate Bill 215 fixes all of that arbitrary issue and alleviates those privacy concerns. And so I, along with thousands of adoptees in South Dakota, would very much appreciate your favorable consideration. Thank you.
Thank you. This is a continuation of the hearing. So are there any other proponents on Senate Bill 215? Any other proponents? Seeing none, we had opponent testimony. Are there any other opponents on Senate Bill 215? Any other opponents? Seeing not, Senator Buell, I'll take this as what you just said is your rebuttal. Okay. With that, I will close this hearing. Okay, go ahead. We'll do questions. Yep, go ahead.
I have a question of, thank you, Madam Chair, of Lynn Banks. Lynn, is she here? In your testimony, you mentioned cases in Tennessee and Oregon. Could you give us more information on those cases?
Okay. Actually, it was the opponent had mentioned.
Do you want to identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's fine. No, this is for our home listening audience.
I'm Lynn Banks from Sioux Falls. There was a Tennessee court ruling, both in Tennessee and Oregon. And in Oregon, it was where all adult, or in Tennessee, it was where all adult adoptees were being granted open access. And there was a group of adoptive parents and birth parents and an agency that went and first tried to take it to federal court, but to state, we were promised confidentiality. But what happened was the federal court threw it back down into the district court. And the district court ruled that the judge's ruling was, that the new law of opening records did not violate constitutional rights to familial and reproductive privacy and privacy against disclosure of confidential information. And what they were saying was that when one is pregnant, it's public. And when one gives birth, the government does not have the right to tell them what they can do with that baby and whether they can, you know, do an adoption. The government does not say you can't do an adoption and with that baby. Therefore, the rights of privacy is not there within our Constitution when it comes to birth parents and your choice of at birth. Does that make sense? Okay. And in both Tennessee and Oregon, with open access, both courts overruled, and they left it that there was open access within those states. And to date, they have open access, and they get their OBCs or their original birth certificates. Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Rampelberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for the Senator. Senator Buell. Senator, as you're sitting down, would you review with me the intent behind line 14 on page 1, which says, actually 13, any adopted person who is at least 18 and who was born in the state, such adopted person's attorney. And then it goes on to say, any descendant of such adopted person. So my question is twofold. Do you really need an attorney? And two, would the descendant have to have an attorney?
Madam Chair?
Okay.
Thank you. Senator, my understanding is that this would not require an attorney, but if someone had opted into having one, that their attorney would not be barred because they're not the adoptee themselves, along with the descendants. If I might add, Madam Chair, the descendants are also included because if the adoptee, him or herself, has passed away, they might not, you know, that person obviously can't request their own records, but the descendant still has a medical record information and interest in finding that original birth certificate, so then they can continue the search more easily. Does that make sense?
We'll follow up. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the other thing then is, if you read up above, it says that in section one, the original certificate should be sealed and may be opened only upon order of a court of competent jurisdiction. And then it says, but for purposes of complying with Section 2 of the Act. And I'm just, I guess I'm curious about this. It doesn't look to me like there is a mandate to overturn that court order. I mean, to obtain a court order in order to open those files. And I'm curious more about the wording, I guess. Do you understand what I'm trying to get at here?
Madam Chair, I think I do. Keep in mind, the Section 1 in the bill is the current law as it stands. Section 2, which adds the process that we've all been talking about, that's the new part. I might also defer to the attorney sponsor on the bill to add some technical advice because I'm not an attorney myself. So would that be all right?
Go ahead.
I'll turn it over.
State Representative Mark Feinstein from District 14. The question again... And the part of the bill?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Feinstein, what I was curious about is, it says in here that it may that this the records may be opened only upon an order of a court of competent jurisdiction. But then when you go into the new section, it doesn't appear as if there is any process for getting an order of a competent jurisdiction. It just says that they may obtain a copy. So I'm curious to know how that might be... you can see my question from before. It looks like only an adopted person's attorney is going to be able to act for the person, and it doesn't look like you have a way to open it up, to unseal it. And I'm being obtuse a bit here, but I don't know how to reconcile it. Thank you.
Well, I'll try really briefly, and then I'll let it go over. I think you're referring to the first section of the bill, which is current law. And we're adding, or for purposes of complying with Section 2. So we're really skipping down. Current law is, what'd you say, you have to go to the court to get the order. And that's what it still could be done that way. Or we could do it the new way. I don't know if that...
Madam Chair, thank you. That it answers my question. I'm not so sure you could do it that way, but then you're the attorney, not me. Thank you, Madam Chair.
May I add to that, Madam Chair?
Go ahead.
I think that the point behind that wording is to not replace or exclude the court order process that exists now, but just to add to it. So it's not an either or, but a both and, so that if someone happened to have retained an attorney or if they'd already begun this process with an attorney prior to this bill theoretically going into effect, then that wouldn't necessarily be ruled out, but it could be an alternative route.
Other questions? Seeing none, thank you. We will close this public hearing to testimony and open it up for discussion and or action.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bradford.
I make motion to do pass.
Second.
It's been moved by Senator Bradford, do pass on Senate Bill 215, seconded by Senator Holine. Any discussion on that motion? Senator Bradford.
Well, I feel this is great. I have adopted children, and I also have a child that I'm a grandchild who I'm very much trying to find, and I'm running into all kinds of roadblocks. But of course, he was born in another state, so. I just would hope this would help somebody in my situation find out about their child. I also did, I mentioned, I think, in my testimony the effects that this might have because my adoptions were done in tribal court, and this would also affect them, the tribal court system, because they have been sanctioned by South Dakota, and all their birth records are here in Pierre, so this would also affect our adoptions. So that was answered for me, too. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Rampelberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make a comment. I wish this were worded a little differently, but I'm going to support it because I really believe that there are an awful lot of people who want to know their history. And I was very sensitive to the fact that there are genetic issues that are involved that people would like to know about. I've had a lot of numerous emails on both sides of the issue, and I know there's mischief that can come from this, but I think the positive nature of the physical as well as just the emotional outweighs the possible mischief, and so I'm going to vote for it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other comments? Seeing none, the bill before us is due pass on Senate Bill 215. Those in favor signify by saying aye. Those opposed, nay. Secretary will call the roll.
Senator Bradford?
Aye.
Holeen?
Aye.
Jensen?
No.
Krebs?
Aye.
Hampelberg?
Aye.
Soholt?
Aye.
Hunhoff?
Aye.
Madam Chair, there are 6 yeas and 1 nay.
Senate Bill 215 has been passed and will go down to the floor. Thank you. You bet. I'm going to redo the agenda, and I apologize, but Senator Jensen has a bill up, so we want to make sure that he's able to address his bill before he leaves because he has another committee. So I'm going to revert the order, and we're going to go to Senate Bill 160. Senate Bill 160 will require health care facilities to allow patients to supply their own prescription medications. Good morning and welcome. I don't think you're on. You need to turn. It's a green light on.
Oh, sorry.
There you go. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Senator Phil Jensen, District 33. Thank you for the opportunity to bring this bill before this committee. This is a patient's rights bill, and I'd like to just briefly read through it. It's pretty short. For an act entitled to require health care facilities to allow patients to supply their own prescription medications, being enacted by the legislature of the state of South Dakota, that chapter 3412 be amended by adding thereto a new section to read as follows. A patient receiving care at a hospital or other health care facility licensed by the state of South Dakota has a right to receive all medication lawfully prescribed to the patient as long as the prescription is ordered or approved by the attending physician. Section 2, that chapter 3412 be amended by adding thereto a new section to read as follows. If a hospital or healthcare facility cannot provide the medication ordered or approved by the attending physician in accordance with the prescription, the patient has a right to supply and self-administer the medication. A hospital or healthcare facility may establish verification, inspection, and storage procedures for prescription medication supplied by the patient to ensure the health and safety of all patients as long as the procedure does not interfere with the patient's right to receive a lawfully prescribed medication. Madam Chair, members of this committee, this bill would actually save lives and would save money. There are approximately 100,000 people that die every single year because of medical mistakes. When a patient comes to the hospital, they should bring their pillowcase full of medications, and the staff can look at these medications and find out whether or not this one's expired. We need to toss it. And this one here contradicts this other one, and so we could have a potential problem there. And so I think that, you know, it could be a win-win for all involved and could make a dent in the fact that we have 100,000 people die every single year from medical mistakes. My insurance man had a very compelling story. His wife had a lung transplant in Boston in 2009. 2012, she broke her leg. She went to regional hospital. They wouldn't let her bring her own Prograf anti-rejection medication into the hospital. It was 2 milligram doses, and they only had 1.5 milligram. And she ended up slipping into a coma. At the end of 4 days, her Boston surgeon was finally able to convince them to let her be life-flighted to Iowa City, Iowa, where they specialize in lung transplants. They made the plane sit on the runway from 10 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. before finally relenting and letting her escape. She almost died. I did receive an email from a Sue Schaefer, South Dakota Pharmacist Association, and she brought up some interesting points. She says, can I identify a tablet or capsule for what it is by the markings? I can't tell you if it's expired. Well, then, you know, if the patient's able to communicate, maybe that can be helpful. And if they can't ascertain that, then toss it. She said, I can't tell if it was in the car at approximately 100 degrees or 125, or if it was minus 30 degrees. Well, if there's a question, then toss it. If it is a capsule, I can't tell you that it hasn't been emptied and something else placed in it. Well, that's true, but the chances of that are pretty slim. She says, I'm responsible for all medications a patient receives while in my facility. If they are taking some of their own and some of ours because of their hospitalization and something goes wrong, whose fault is it? Mine or theirs? Where's the liability? Well, I don't see why a patient signing a waiver wouldn't cover that particular issue. And then she says, concerning regulatory issues, if the patient is taking a controlled substance like Vicodin, how can I secure it and account for it? Same way you always do. How do I audit for diversion when I'm not sure what is the patient's and what is mine? Well, how do you keep meds that one patient has separate from another patient's meds? You know, I don't think that's not doable. What happens if they run out of their medication and begin using the hospitals? Well, you make a note. If the patient is a Medicare patient and is admitted under an inpatient and not an outpatient, we are required to provide all of their medication as part of the DRG. If they are admitted as an outpatient and are such from 48 hours and then are admitted, their DRG stay is retro, the original admission date and time. You know, I find it hard to believe that this couldn't be workable and that this couldn't be dealt with by a meeting of the minds. She goes on and says, how do I replace the medications that have been used out of their own supply? Well, you make a note of it, and then you're able to account for it. I mean, every hospital has to account for their particular meds that they get, and this wouldn't be any different. CMS, DEA, and DOH requires all medications in the facility to be secured. How will I secure these medications and account for them? The same way you do now. And to me, the bottom line is it's all about the money. I think when you have to pay $8 for an aspirin, I think that's probably on the low end. And a patient can bring their own aspirin. I don't see any reason why that can't be allowed. And I will stand by for further questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Are there any questions for the Senator? Seeing none, thank you. Are there other proponents for Senate Bill 160? Other proponents? Good morning and welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Blaine Campbell, Representative District 35, Pennington County. And with your permission, I'm here from the standpoint of a patient in regards to this proposed legislation. I've had a couple of experiences, specifically in Rapid City, in the hospital there, that I hope will give you the personal side of this issue. I have basically two experiences to relate. Both of them involved in being admitted to the hospital and having a bag of my own medication, seven different medications prescribed by heart doctors. And in the first instance, I was medicating and doing quite well, because there's a set routine. Once you have X amount of medications, and some are required in the morning, some at night, some once a day, and you acquire a routine that is good for you, the patient. As soon as the hospital discovered what I was doing, they politely and graciously informed me that that wasn't allowed, that they would have to provide the medications, which they did. But there was a great deal of time passing until everything was back on my schedule. And that's disruptive for me, and in a couple of cases, they made errors in the amount that had been originally prescribed and ended up being greater in two cases. So it was, I considered it disruptive, and the other issue, of course, is cost. You're paying hospital cost for medications, which is not wholesale, that is retail. And in purchasing my medications, I would say it's more like wholesale cost. I don't carry my meds in pharmacy containers, because they're rather large, and if you were to try to hide them on your person, it would be pretty obvious that you were a drug addict, and I say that in humor, hopefully. I see, as Senator Jensen said, that there ought to be a possibility where patients of sound mind and body who are used to medicating themselves through prescription meds prescribed by a doctor ought to be able to take them to the hospital and keep their routine intact. And that's primarily my side of the issue. And I appreciate your attention, and I'll stand by for questions.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Other proponents to Senate Bill 160. Other proponents. Last time, other proponents. Seeing none, are there opponents to Senate Bill 160? Opponents. Good morning and welcome.
Thank you. My name's Dana Darger. I'm a pharmacist in the state of South Dakota. I've been a pharmacist for a very long time, pushing about 35 years now. I am opposed to this bill. There's several reasons. Several of them are the ones that Senator Jensen mentioned, and his solutions for them are not practical. Patients come to us with medications, then that's correct. But when they come to us, usually when they're sick, they're coming to the hospital, we're going to add medications to whatever it is that's causing that admission. And without knowing exactly what they're on and being able to control what they're on, we can't know what the drug interactions are. We can't know what those side effects will be. We can't know that a drug is expired or not. As the representative said, he doesn't keep his in a bottle. I would have no idea if those medications are expired or not. We don't put expiration dates on bottles when we fill them as prescriptions, so we wouldn't know. And even worse than that is when you find and I'm not picking anyone, but an 80-year-old who found a bottle that she liked because she could get the lid off of it, she will take the pills and pour them into that old bottle every time she gets a refill because that lid she can get open. That happens all the time. We would have no way of knowing. I know that there's that thought that a patient would alter their own prescriptions and put something else in a capsule would not happen. That's not true. Patients that have addictions that are know they're coming to the hospital will empty out their Prozac out of the capsule and fill it with morphine or an opiate because they know we're not going to give them enough. I mean, we've seen that. And so there's the whole question about can we or can we not identify a tablet or capsule is not relevant. We can tell you that it is a tablet. I can't tell you. I can tell you what the drug is or is supposed to be. Can I tell you that it's been properly stored? No. And yet, while that patient's in our care, we're responsible for their medications. There is the regulatory issues. To me, the bigger issue, though, is really the patient safety. And we need to know what our patients are on and what they're taking. And the only way to do that is for us to supply those medications while they're in our care. Do we have misadventures? Yes. There are times when mistakes are made in hospitals. Do 100,000 patients die from medication errors? No. 100 patients have misadventures in hospitals and die. That is correct. That is a valid number, but it's not from medication errors always. There are wrong site surgeries. There's all kinds of things that impact that number. We do make errors. I'm not going to deny that. But we do address those errors. We try to fix them. We try to make sure that they don't happen to the next patient that comes into our care. We evaluate all those errors when they happen in our facility. We need to do what we can to protect our patients. But the best way we can protect them is for us to know, and really, I know it sounds bad, but be in control of the medications they're getting while they're in our care. The issues with compliance, there is a huge problem with the DRG system. I tell patients all the time they need to talk to our U.S. Congresspeople. If you want this to get fixed, that whole observation outpatient status needs to be fixed, but it needs to be fixed at the federal level, not at the state level. There's nothing we can do about it. It does cause compliance problems for the hospital. Those are my primary concerns. We are here trying to protect the safety of our patients. Allowing patients to bring in medications from outside will not improve safety. In fact, it will decrease the safety of those patients when they're in our care. That's my opinion as a pharmacist, having done this for a very, very long time. And I'm a little bit offended that it would be suggested that this is about the money. It is not about the money. I would give these drugs away if I could. CMS says I can't. CMS says that that's an inducement for service, and so it's trying to get people to come to my hospital. It's not about the money. It's about the safety. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Senator Bradford.
When, and of course, you all know, I just recently went in for a little heart surgery, and when before I was admitted, they asked me, what are you taking?
Mm-hmm.
And I told them, and my heart doctor had prescribed all this. And to me, why couldn't I have that medicine that was already through their heart doctor was prescribed to me and I received, of course, in my case, I get my medicine through IHS. So why couldn't they say, call them and say, what medicines are this person on? Look in there, and those medicines that he has, why couldn't he use those?
The biggest reason for me for saying I don't think that's safe is we know patients don't always take care of their medicines correctly. They don't store them properly. I would challenge you that the majority you probably keep your medications in the bathroom. The bathroom is absolutely the worst place to store medications because of the heat and humidity in a bathroom. Those will degrade medications quicker than anything you can imagine. And yet, that's where the majority of Americans keep their medications. The ones we store at the hospital are stored under controlled conditions. They need to be refrigerated, if they're at room temperature. We know that the drugs that we're using are stable and effective, and we know that they're at the right dose. I can't tell you that about anything that any patient brings to me that has been properly stored. It's not possible. And so if I think you're getting a certain dose of a certain drug and what you're getting is not the right dose because that medication was not properly stored or it's not expired and outdated, I don't know where you're at. So then we start adjusting doses and giving you more of a drug that we think you're on this dose, and we adjust your dose. And then when you go home, we're going to be back in the same place we were at before. And so it really does not, I understand what you're saying. You have a prescription bottle with that drug in it. But when you come to us, usually it's because something's changed. Your clinical condition is not stable any longer. And we're going to start making changes. And without knowing exactly what it is you're on, we can't do it appropriately.
Go ahead.
Well, I don't store mine in my bathroom, but anyway, if by storing my medicine's going to make me sick or some kind of reaction, I'd have already had that before I got there. Wouldn't I?
Want to answer?
Pardon?
Would you like to answer?
That may be why you're there. I'm sorry, but it could be. I mean, we see these things happen when the patients come to us. It's because their medications aren't doing what we thought they should be doing.
Okay. Senator Krebs? Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question is for Dana. Where are you a pharmacist at?
Rapid City Regional.
Any other questions for this individual? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Other opponents to Senate Bill 160. Other opponents.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Dave Hewitt, representing the South Dakota Association of Healthcare Organizations. It's times like this that I wish I was had some clinician training, but I can talk only from the experience I've had talking with many clinicians over the last several years as health and patient safety and improved quality in the acute care setting has become more and more of an issue. Starting at the federal level, hospital errors are now on the website. Medication errors, hospital-acquired infections, all these are on the website, and it really has focused over the last 3 or 4 years new emphasis on making sure that care is delivered in the safest possible manner. And one of the major areas of consideration are medication errors, because that was really a big cause for hospital readmissions and prolonging acute care stays. When people come to a hospital, when they're admitted to a hospital, they're not there because things are the same. They are there because they are suffering from a specific condition that brought them there. And they, at that time, as you would know, Senator Bradford, you're there because something changed in your life that you require acute care services. And in that setting, where the care is delivered by just an army, if you will, of healthcare professionals headed up by an admitting physician, they need to be in complete control. And it may be that the routine that you have of taking both prescription drugs and, for that matter, over-the-counter drugs may in fact not fit what you're trying, fit the care that you're trying to receive in the hospital setting. Personal example. I mean, if I'm going in for a colonoscopy, granted an outpatient procedure, I have to quit taking my baby aspirin, you know, 3 or 4 days ahead of time so that in fact something bleeds, I'm not, you know, it, my blood will coagulate properly. Blood thinners, you know, you just can't do that in the hospital setting if you're going to be having surgery. So, you know, it's you can say, well, it's going to save money, it's more convenient, I know what's going on. But the fact of the matter is, when you're in a hospital setting, your life has changed. And the hospital is under great pressure to make sure that the care that you receive is the safest, highest quality possible. And when you allow deviations from that, when the hospital does not know what's going on with your entire health status, that's a problem. And that can create problems for the hospital, and it ultimately increases costs. You can say, the author of this bill says, well, we can save costs. Well, you know, it only takes one medical error to increase costs in a way that could cover this probably 1,000 times over. So it is important that you oppose this piece of legislation, because the hospital is a very special place where very special care is being delivered, and it has to be overseen by those healthcare professionals. So I would urge you to oppose Senate Bill 160. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, are there other opponents to Senate Bill 160? Other opponents to 160? Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am Deb Fisher-Clemens. I am the policy person for Avera Health, the healthcare system that has many critical access hospitals, long-term care facilities, and large hospitals across the state. And we have policies in place that deal with patients who, in fact, need to take their own medications, and it is an option that is available to patients per their request. I have contacted several of our facilities to verify that the policies and what kinds of differences there are. There are differences, and it is always up to the patient to make those requests. And if, in fact, they can meet those patients' requests, that is absolutely done. But there are huge concerns about quality. You've heard about that from other folks today. But policies and procedures are really what we need to have to maintain standards, to maintain quality, and to assure that patients receive the appropriate medications at the appropriate times, and we have those policies in place. I also understand that there are veterans. We make special exceptions for veterans because of the fact that they get their medications in a way that we can make that work, and we change our policies to make those things happen. So it's very important to maintain quality. Policies and procedures do that, and for that reason, we would ask you to vote against Senate Bill 160. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other further opponents for Senate Bill 160? Any other opponents? Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Dayock. I'm the director of the South Dakota Healthcare Association, representing long-term care providers across our state. We would strongly encourage you to defer Senate Bill 160 to the 41st legislative day. In its current form, I think you've heard this bill could raise very serious issues of patient safety and also significantly increase potential liability for long-term care providers. Facilities right now keep a very strict inventory of controlled substances in order to protect against adverse drug interactions. To maintain this needed control, there's a great deal of oversight, and medications are administered in a very set way, for example, oftentimes through blister packs. Administering these drugs in a very set way also protects against drug diversion, as you've heard. So again, I would respectfully request that you consider moving Senate Bill 160 to the 41st legislative day. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Seeing none, are there other opponents to Senate Bill 160? Other opponents to Senate Bill 160? Not seeing any. Senator Jensen, you can, from your seat, give rebuttal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for Mr. Darga from Rapid City.
I'm sorry, you have to come up to the microphone.
Yeah, they told me that.
Yes, sir. I do appreciate your being here. If you can't give your meds away, then why not reduce their prices significantly?
This is a lesson in healthcare economics, which I wish I had had time to explain.
You want to identify yourself.
Oh, yes.
Home audience.
Yes. Dana Darger from as a pharmacist representing myself. But I'll try to give you the Reader's Digest version of why. Pharmacy is a revenue-generating department in a not-for-profit hospital in our state for the most part. There are several departments when you come to visit us that you never get a bill from. The person that admitted you at the admitting desk doesn't give you a bill. The one in medical records that files your medical record and us maintaining that medical record for as long as you're alive, you don't get a bill for them. You don't get one from our billing office for filing your insurance for you so that you don't have to do it. So in the end, what happens is departments like pharmacy and lab and radiology, which are billable services, I can't say anything other than excessive amounts, but it's so that we can cover the cost of running a hospital. It's not about the cost of the drug itself. You have a pharmacy department supplying it. You have a nursing department administering it. Those all add up, too. And so pharmacy is a revenue-generating department, and it covers those departments that can't bill, that don't have any revenue.
Okay. Follow-up, Madam Chair. As far as storage, why don't you just ask the patients where they store their meds at home?
If you've ever been involved in direct patient care, the likelihood of getting an honest answer from a patient about anything, if I ask a patient how many drinks do they have a week and they tell me two, you can usually about triple whatever they tell you. The same thing would be true, I think, if I asked them where they might tell me where they store their medications. They might not. What do I do about the guy, though, that is the representative who says he doesn't like carrying around his bottles, so he's got them in a little box? How do I, I can tell you if he's carrying around on his body where it's warm and everything else, those are probably not as good. Depends on how long they've been there. But, there's too many variables. We just can't know. And the responsibility is mine. If I have a medication misadventure while that patient's in my care, it's my responsibility. And if they're getting stuff from me and stuff that they brought in with themselves, I have no idea what's going on with that patient.
Madam Chair, one last question.
Last question, and then your rebuttal, please. Thank you.
Okay. If a hospital or health care, this is on line 11, if a hospital or health care facility cannot provide the medication ordered or approved by the attending physician in accordance with the prescription, why not let them provide their own?
We do. I think every hospital in the state has policies and procedures currently in place to allow patients to get the medications they need. We do allow patients to use their own medications when we can't do anything else. We have policies, we have processes that take care of that at the present time.
Well, Mrs. Griffith about died because Regional would not let her have her medication.
Senator, we need to keep focused, okay? Thank you. So your rebuttal, please.
Madam Chair, this is an issue that really needs to be dealt with, and I see a total unwillingness on the part of the hospitals to work with patients on an issue that could save lives as well as money. So I would encourage the committee to vote to affirm 160. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Jensen. Again, do any committee members have any questions of any of the people that have provided testimony? Seeing none, at this time, I will close this hearing to public testimony and open it up for discussion and or action. Senator Solholt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really do appreciate the spirit that Senator Jensen and Representative Campbell brought this bill forward. I think it's an interesting dialogue because of the federal regulations in quality control and what happens in the accountability, liability, responsibility of the healthcare organizations, and then melding that with personal responsibility and cost. I will say that 20 years ago, helped develop enabling policy in the areas that I worked in at the time of obstetrics to allow ibuprofen brought in, prenatal vitamins that were prescription already, verifying that, saying there's no need to further even allowing self-administration in those instances that we were verifying that they were at the bedside. And so I believe that this issue is really an issue of policy at the local level with the hospitals. I can't imagine anyone where there's expensive medications, unique medications, that they're already in the healthcare loop, that can't be accounted for and worked on, that the pharmacist becomes the counselor to the situation, and that the policies that exist for the unit are in place so that this can be handled. So I do not believe that we do need this legislation. I think there is enabling mechanisms already to treat this at the hospital and healthcare and long-term care facility level. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Senator Bradford.
Well, the opponent testimony was really good, I got to tell you that. I mean, I even myself. But I can't see why, at least if I bring my meds in their proper bottle and have them and they look at them and everything, I can't see why. Because, as I said, I get my meds from IHS, and I go into Rapid City, they're gone. So there's somewhere we have to work this out, and I understand. I mean, I understand the pharmacist side, and I understand Rapid City because there is people, and somehow those people who are really concerned with their meds, take care of them, keep them and do all these things. And the cost factor is important. I want to tell you something, man. I had a lot of repeat stuff that I'd already had done that I had to have done over again just because that was their policy when I just went in. And I'm going to pay for that because IHS, that's not a life-threatening thing. So there is some financial importance because those of us who are at my age, a lot of us are living on a very fixed income. And any variation in that means a lot. And so I'm not sure this is the bill to do it. So
thank you, Senator Bradford. Action Committee.
Madam Chair.
Senator Krebs.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move a deferral motion to the 41st day on Senate Bill 160.
Second.
It's been moved by Senator Krebs, second by Senator Solholt, Senate Bill 160 to the 41st day. Any comments on that motion?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. As we heard in our testimony today, specifically in the opponent testimony, I can understand the concerns that our proponents have brought forth, and I share in their passion as far as this particular issue, and hopefully some resolution can be worked out on those individual basis. Sometimes as a legislature, we're brought forth some pieces of legislation that tries to fix one person's or one constituent's problem, and it doesn't always cover all the bases and nor solve the problem. And so we heard the opponent testimony that says we already have these things in place that if you and if the hospital or the clinic cannot get a hold of a product or a piece of medication, that then you are able to do that and bring your own in, so to speak. So I feel that this legislation may go a little too far on regulating some of the concerns or some of the challenges that hospitals already are faced with every day. We know that drug use will continue to be a problem, and I think that we need to make sure that we follow the hospital standards in controlling what our patients are bringing into the facilities. And I would respectfully urge you to defer Senate Bill 160 to the 41st day.
Thank you. Any other comments? Senator Rampelberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I feel it is incumbent upon me to make a few comments here, because I am one of the sponsors on the bill. When my mother was in the hospital with ovarian cancer, they took away all of her meds. She was terrified because she knew that she was going to have pain, and she wasn't sure that they were going to take care of her pain. I was furious. I was going to do battle. Recently, one of the guys in my church is I've known for 30 years. He's elderly. He's in an assisted living right now. He came to me and said, "Bruce, they won't let me take my own meds." I was furious. I was ready to do battle. Well, guess what I found out? He sometimes forgets and will take more than he should or not any at all. And they're looking out for his best interest. When the good senator brought this to me, I said, "You bet, I'm ready to do battle." And yet, I remembered I was in the hospital myself here about 6 months ago, and I had all my meds. But the point was, every 12 hours, I had a different hospitalist. My family doctor had nothing to do with anything that was going on in the hospital. It was all hospitalists. Everything they did was done by the computer. Everybody that walked in went up to the computer and did a bunch of stuff to it. And I looked at it and I thought to myself, how do you keep track of all of these things if you did or didn't do something if you're under somebody else's care? And so I'm sitting here, I'm apologizing to the good senator because I'm sitting here thinking, now as I look at it, I think it's in the best interest of the person if somebody really is helping them with this where they're maybe not thinking right. So I'm going to support the deferral motion, but I would also urge some more additional thought on this on part of the care providers. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. With that, the motion before the committee is on 160 to send to the 41st day. Those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye. Those opposed, nay. Secretary will call the roll.
Senators Bradford. Senator,
no.
Did he say nay? Holine.
Aye.
Jensen.
No.
Krebs.
Aye.
Rampelberg.
Aye.
Soholt.
Aye.
Hunhoff.
Aye.
Madam Chair, there are 5 yeas and 2 nays.
Thank you. Motion has carried. Senate Bill 160 will go to the 41st day. Thank you. With that, we'll move now to House Bill 1011, which authorizes the Board of Hearing Aid Dispensers and Audiologists to establish a 30-day trial period for the sale of hearing aids. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Michael Collarin. I am a member of the Audiology or Board of Hearing Aid Dispensers and Audiologist Board, and specifically I am a complaints officer investigator for that board. This is a consumer-oriented bill, straightforward. South Dakota does not have a mandated trial period for hearing aids. The majority of the states in South Dakota do have, of states in the United States do have a trial period of some sort for hearing aids. We're not trying to be like the other states. We are doing this specific to concerns of our board. As the complaints officer, I looked in the past year to two complaints being directly addressed to the board. We're about 6 to 9, someplace in that area there, and they were always specific to the question of trial periods, lack of trial periods, ambiguity in the contracts that people were receiving in regard to a trial period. And as some of our folks related to us from the Attorney General's office, the contracts were legal. They're obnoxious, but they were legal. They were legal contracts. And so we need to do something for the consumer to have something straightforward for the consumer to understand and for the providers, dispensers and audiologists, so that everybody's on the same playing field. And up front, I'll let you know that this was a concern, like, because of the number of complaints that we were dealing with. But last winter, about this time, I think it was, we were in a board meeting, and this was the concern that we were having, and so we decided to bring in the folks from Consumer Affairs and get some feedback from them. And let me tell you, I was glad that they weren't there. They were on telephone from here in Pierre. We were out in Deadwood having the meeting, because I turned 50 shades of red when I was informed by them that in regard to hearing aid complaints that they had received 39 complaints. I was taken back over about a five-year period of time, all related to the issue of contract and trial period. I think after they got off the phone, we all looked at each other at that board meeting and says, we can't continue this. We've got to deal with this for the consumer. That's what we're here for as a board, to regulate the practice of hearing aid dispensers and audiologists and to protect the consumer. So this is a pretty straightforward bill. We reviewed many bills across the country. Some were extremely tedious, and so we worked down to, I think, a straightforward bill that I think everybody can work with, and we've had some discussions, and I think it's a good bill, and I hope that we can go forward with it. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? I do have.
Great.
Okay. In the area of, you said the 39 complaints, what are the complaints? I mean, what is it specifically about the hearing aids?
The complaints were that people assumed they were getting a trial period. They were getting a trial period, but the way the contracts were written, it was just about impossible to meet those criteria that was set forth in the contract to be able to say, okay, I've gone through this trial period that this person has given me and met all of their guidelines of what I was supposed to be doing. There was even some contracts that said if you were having difficulties during that trial period, you will be required to go to Minneapolis to the manufacturer and deal with the manufacturer and their folks up there to deal with the problem. It was not a consumer oriented trial period. It was just about impossible to get out of it.
Okay, I didn't ask the question correctly. So this is a contract issue in the sense. But what's the complaint? Is the device doesn't work, I can't hear, and I said I was supposed to, or it doesn't fit, or what?
A number of those, where I just can't get used to the sound, I can't adjust to it, the physical fit isn't good, they've redone this, but it's still not good. Most of these issues could be taken care of by the dispensers and audiologists, and appropriately, but again, you have people that just don't adjust to it well, and they shouldn't be stuck with something they can't work with. It doesn't serve their purpose and doesn't serve the purpose of the audiologist or dispenser who's trying to help them.
One last question. I'm not trying to be difficult,
no.
But if I've got the contract, I guess, does it say in the contract that these are the reasons that you can return it within the 30 days, or is it's left up to... I guess if you've got this contract and I can take it back, I mean, I could try something for 30 days and go to somebody else and, you know, I'm just saying that it doesn't, I understand what you're saying, but it's like it leaves the person that's selling that product, he's just, or she is just, well, I guess I've got to, you know, give them back their money or whatever, because whatever, they're unhappy.
For the number of hearing aids that are dispensed, I think, in the state of South Dakota, and the number that are returned, I don't think you're going to see that as an issue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Other proponents for House Bill 1011? Other proponents? Seeing none, are there opponents to House Bill 1011? Any opponents? Seeing none, there's waive the rebuttal and open up for committee question. Any questions? Senator Rampelberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A clarification for the bill sponsor, if you will. I'm just curious, on page two, it says that a violation of this section is a Class 2 misdemeanor. Is that in the existing bill, or is that part of the... I guess maybe... I see that you have... You have amended this with the portion beginning with line 11 that's underlined. But when you go to the page 2, line 1, I'm just curious to know if this is part of the original bill.
This was existing.
Okay. You know, this is interesting. I mean, there are returns for every business in the country. I mean, I'm sitting here thinking, why are we in the middle of this? But from what you're telling me, it appears that it's an unresolvable issue amongst their particular profession. So anyway, thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Bradford, you had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I wondered how, and of course this answers some of what you said about the guy going from place to place, is the 10%. They do retain 10%. So, my question is, how'd you come at that figure?
That figure is a pretty much, as we looked across the country at various bills, that was a pretty common number in terms of how much was being retained by the dispenser audiologist to help defer certain costs of time costs and product costs, that ear molds that were made specific for that person that is not going to be able to be returned to the manufacturer, specific costs.
Go ahead.
Well, you know, and I understand that, but if I put a hearing aid in and go home that night and I'm back the next day and say, hey, man, this thing is absolutely unbearable, that's a lot different than using it for 29 days and then coming back. But
right.
Anyway, thank you.
And understandable, and I think, do I need to say who I am again? I'm sorry, Mike Collarn from the South Dakota Board of Hearing Aid Dispensers and Audiologists. I think that most often, I don't think we've seen, in my practice of 30 years, I haven't seen people very, very seldom that have come back the next day and just put them on the table, so to speak, and said, I give up. Most of the time, they're going to give you a chance to say, okay, it's a fit issue. Let's go ahead and try to do some buffing or some adjusting on that. That doesn't occur that often.
All right. Thank you. With that, I will close this hearing to public testimony and open it up for discussion and or action.
Madam Chair.
Senator Krebs.
Madam Chair, move do pass House Bill 1011.
Second.
It's been moved by Senator Krebs, do pass on House Bill 1011, seconded by Senator Rampelberg. Any comments on that motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the board bringing forth a consumer protection concern, and obviously complaints are a part of that, and we appreciate you recognizing that and trying to alleviate that concern at the same time protecting the consumer and yet working with the industry by them being able to retain a little bit back on that return of that 10%. So, Madam Chair, I urge you and members of the committee a do pass on House Bill 1011.
Thank you. The motion before you is do pass on House Bill 1011. Those in favor signify by saying aye. Those opposed, nay. Secretary will call the roll.
Senators Bradford.
Aye.
Helene.
Aye.
Jensen. Krebs.
Aye.
Rampelberg.
Aye.
Sohal.
Aye.
Hunoff.
Aye.
Madam Chair, there are 6 yeas and 1 excused.
Thank you. House Bill 1011 has been passed and will go down to the floor. Senator Bradford, will you carry the bill on the floor?
Certainly.
Thank you. With that, we'll move to House Bill 1047, which revises certain provisions regarding the examination for an application for a funeral service license. Good morning and welcome.
Madam Chairman and Chairwoman and other members of the committee, I'm Howard Song, a licensed funeral director and co-owner of a funeral home in Watertown, and a member of the State Board of Funeral Service, and I'm here on their behalf. House Bill 1047 provides authorization for the funeral board to appoint a board member, a designee of the board or board staff selected by majority of the board to administer the state funeral exam. The current law is cumbersome and outdated in that it requires a quorum of the board to be present during the exam. We do not know of any other profession that requires a full board to be present during a written exam. The board only meets in person once per year, meeting by teleconference or DDN the other times throughout the year to be cost effective. With current statute, new applicants would only be allowed to test one time per year during the in-person meeting. The revised legislation will provide the applicant the quickest and most feasible option while maintaining the integrity of the examination in order to get licensed and begin providing services to the public. The board will have guidelines established for the administration of the exam to keep the reliability and validity of the exam. We ask for your support of House Bill 1047.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Are there other proponents for House Bill 1047? Other proponents? Any proponents? Okay, seeing none, are there any opponents for House Bill 1047? Any opponents? Seeing none, we'll waive rebuttal. Any further questions by the committee on this bill? Seeing none, we will close this hearing to public testimony and open it up for discussion and or action.
Madam Chair.
Senator Sohol.
Thank you. I would move due pass House Bill 1047.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved by Senator Sohol, second by Senator Krebs. Due pass on House Bill 1047. Any comments on that motion? Hearing none, the motion before you is due pass on House Bill 1047. Those in favor signify by saying aye. Those opposed, nay. Secretary will call the roll.
Senators Bradford.
Aye.
Jensen. Holeen.
Aye.
Krebs.
Aye.
Rampelberg.
Aye.
Soholt.
Aye.
Hanoff.
Aye.
Madam Chair, there are six yeas, one excused.
Thank you. House Bill 1047 has passed this committee and will go down to the floor.
Madam Chair.
Senator Soholt.
Move consent.
Second.
Been moved by Senator Soholt, second by Senator Rampelberg for consent. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. Motion carried. The bill will go on consent.
The bill is a dead cinch.
With that, we have concluded our agenda. I want to thank all the committee members and those of you in attendance. I'd entertain a motion to adjourn.
Second.
Moved by Senator Holeen, second by Senator Soholt. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion carried. We are adjourned.